We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to Atheist Nomads Episode 9. Later in the episode, we'll be discussing the Jesus Myth Hypothesis with Dr. Robert M. Price.
Woohoo!
This episode was recorded on August 25th, 2012, for release on August 30, 2012. I'm Dustin Williams, and joining me as always is Wesley.
Hello.
How's it going, Wesley?
It's going great, thank you. How about yourself?
Ah, tired. Long, stressful, busy week at work. How was your week?
I sat on my ass and surfed Facebook. Ha ha.
Damn you. Wow.
Your tax dollar is hard at work, sir. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, man. The bureaucratic waste of it all.
Oh, wait. I photocopied for like a half hour.
Okay.
I did.
Okay.
That makes it all better.
So a half hour of actual work for a 40-hour paycheck.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Wow. And people wonder why we have such a big deficit.
Okay. All you guys out there, don't tell anybody. All right. Government jobs, the best little secret nobody knows about. Get yourself one if you can.
Yeah. All right. The next campaign season, somebody needs to run for president campaigning on labor efficiency in government departments.
Yes. So it ain't so, man.
Or we might have to wait a few years till I'm old enough to run, and I'll campaign on that.
Okay, now you're making me wish and hope that atheists can't get elected.
All right, let's go ahead and get started with feedback. And we got an email from Christy, who had a very helpful correction. And anytime one of us says something that's just patently wrong, feel free to correct us. And so what she said was the genetic link for resistance to HIV is much older than a few decades. Research is still ongoing. When I first heard about this 8 years ago, the top theory from what I'd heard at the time was increased resistance to the Black Plague. A quick search to check my own facts yielded this article. And I got a link to the article from Wired in the show notes. And it looks like the genes that protect some people from HIV infection may be traced back hundreds of years, possibly even to the Vikings.
Wow.
So, yes, I was wrong with saying a few decades. And of course I was wrong with saying a few decades. You can't have genetic stuff happen in less than a generation.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah. So obviously I was wrong. I was talking out of my ass at that point. So, sorry.
And Christy, hello. So, yeah, she's actually a friend of mine. Met her with the Ask an Atheist crew. Real good people. Like her a lot.
Cool. And looking at this article, and it's from 2005, this genetic HIV resistance appears to have been initiated by just some random mutation that ended up being spread and continued on being evolutionarily advantageous based on resistance to certain diseases. And they haven't quite, at least as of 2005, they hadn't quite tracked down the exact disease. The leading theories at that point were either dysentery or smallpox.
Huh.
And so you have something that common and a genetic mutation that has the, you know, very fortunate side effect of causing some resistance to diseases. Well, that's obviously those with it will be more likely to live on and reproduce and pass those genes on. It's been spread to an estimated 10-15% of those descended from Northern European populations.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, it's a lower level of protection than some that get it from both sides of the family, from both parents. But still, 10-15% of people from Northern European populations have this particular genetic defect, or excuse me, not necessarily genetic defect, but mutated gene in the CCR5 receptor.
Actually pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
The way I understand it, a lot of our genes, you know, there's really not much purpose to them until something crops up or another mutation that comes along, and then it could be beneficial or harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and this one happens to be one that's been very beneficial for quite a while.
Yeah.
And right. It turns out, see, the Swedes are most likely to be protected.
Well, all right. At least it's not the Swiss.
What's your problem with the Swiss?
I just don't like anybody that's that neutral. Have an opinion, man. Damn it.
The Swedes have tried to be as neutral.
Yeah.
They're not very as anywhere near as good at neutrality, but they try.
Yeah. The Swiss, though. It's kind of like the Dutch. Oh, the Dutch. They always smell like cabbage. I don't like it.
Really? Really? Of course, Futurama, you have the neutral planet and the neutral people that are so incredibly neutral that they have no opinion on any topic. They're all completely gray. Their clothing is all gray, and their planet is completely gray.
Odd.
Yeah. Well, leave it to Futurama.
I was just going with the Austin Powers reference for the Dutch.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Anyways.
Yes.
Now that we've beat that one.
Are you ready for history?
I suppose. So, this day in history, August 30th, 30 BCE. Cleopatra commits suicide. The Queen of Egypt and lover of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony takes her own life after the defeat against Octavian, the first future emperor of Rome. There's actually a historical Cleopatra, you know, from a time well before Jesus. And look, we actually have, like, written records of her. Go figure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just a little segue. Sorry. All right.
Well, and when you look at the Egyptian monarchs of that time, the pharaohs, the Ptolemies, to be more precise, they were all descended from one of Alexander the Great's generals, and they adapted a lot of Egyptian customs. But you had 300 years of Egypt being ruled by Greeks.
Yeah. Is it Ptolemy? I always thought it was Ptolemy.
Oh, yeah, it is Ptolemy. Damn. Yeah, Ptolemy. You're right. But one kind of creepy thing that the Ptolemies adopted from their actual Egyptian predecessors was the incest.
Yeah, the brother-sister stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Creepy.
A little odd, but, you know, I think that's where the saying blue blood comes in from the British.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of all the tying back in.
Yeah. Now, Cleopatra, of course, did try to break things up a little bit by getting on with Caesar and Antony, but...
I think those were just the fun on the side.
Yeah?
Just a feeling.
Could be.
Anyways, yeah, Cleopatra, she committed suicide so that she wouldn't be captured at the ripe old age of 39 years old. Yeah, poor girl. But had a pretty good life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Next one. This day in history, August 30th, 1918. Vladimir Lenin is shot. This didn't kill him, but it sure sparked a lot of repercussions and basically made Russia fall much deeper into their civil war. Yeah, yeah. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. It is the original name for Lenin. He was born in 1870. And... basically the founder of the Bolsheviks and the working class.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about him?
No, after he took control of Russia, he pulled him out of World War I and established the Soviet Union. He's the guy that started it all. And what's kind of funny is he was, you know, an anti-imperialist who created an empire even larger than the one that he'd overthrown.
Well, the way I understand it, he was pretty much anti-government also, but he kind of formed the people's government, if you want to call it that, the communists.
Yeah, which, you know, the theory behind it's all good. It's that you have the people own everything and have all the power, but in all practicality,
it sucks.
The people are represented by a few people who own everything and have all the power.
Again, a government.
Yeah. In the end, it's not all that different than what you get in a capitalist society, except it's a monopoly. It's one giant monopoly. And at least we have, you know, while we have power concentrated and wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, at least they compete with each other.
Yeah. And instead of everybody owning everything, quote unquote, I'd rather get stock options from the company I work for.
But you work for the government. You're a socialist.
Oh, yeah. Man, you don't know how much I have to put up with hearing about all those evil socialist agendas at work.
Wait, from people that get government paychecks.
Yeah. Like, oh, you know, Obama's trying to put in his socialist medical programs. And like, seriously, our cops, our schools, our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh, that's different. That's different. You know what? No, it's really not.
Yeah. And people that are already servants of the people shouldn't be griping about it.
You'd think.
Oh, wow.
These are the same people that don't read their Bibles, but believe in them anyway. I'm telling you, it's awesome. I love it.
Mm.
I really don't.
Yeah, of course, getting back to Lenin, he finally died in 1924. And after some people fought for power for a little while, Joseph Stalin finally took over. And he's responsible for killing something like 50 million people.
Mm.
Real bad guy. Real bad guy.
Well, there's something to be said for no competition.
Well, the thing is, to maintain that, you have to kill off anybody that wants to compete with you. That is, if you can't just intimidate them. And often, you know, killing is more efficient than more conventional means of intimidation. Plus, it'll intimidate everybody else.
All right, next one. This day in history, August 30th, 1967, Thurgood Marshall is confirmed as Supreme Court Justice. All right, so this is the first black guy that gets into the Supreme Court. It's pretty damn cool, actually. He had actually been a lawyer for a long time before he got in there, fighting, arguing cases in the Supreme Court on numerous occasions. A little bit about his history, though. He was pretty much primed to go into a legal profession. I mean, his parents instilled a love for the Constitution. He actually went to when he was going through school, if he was punished, which they don't say if he was punished often, but you know, they actually made him read government documents like the Constitution again, or the go through the amendments. But when he graduated, he tried to get into the Maryland School of Law, but was turned away because of the school segregation policy. He ended up going to Howard University, which is an excellent, just about all black school. I think it was all black at the time. Graduated magna cum laude in 1933.
That's kind of impressive. Funny
it is.
Magna cum laude from law school? Yeah.
Yeah. And what was one of the things that he did later? Oh, he went back and sued the Maryland School of Law, which he originally applied to, for their unfair admissions policy. To me, that's just fucking hilarious.
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
boy.
It is.
But he was also a big part in the Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. That's the case where Marshall argued separate but equal principles were unconstitutional and designed to keep blacks basically in slavery. So, man, this is one of the best guys to have in a position of power. He worked his ass off. He fought for stuff that needed to be changed, and I'd say he did more than basically any religious leader out there ever did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he spent 24 years working for the rights of the disenfranchised.
Yeah, man.
Promoting equality. That's pretty damn cool. He's also one of the few Supreme Court justices that you actually learn about and know that wasn't Chief Justice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I grew up knowing about Thurgood Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did too. Generally, yeah, other than that, once they're gone, everybody forgets about them. Sure, they stay in history.
What are you talking about? But most people don't know about them even when they're in there.
Okay, at least come on. Among geeks.
Who's the one that you really know about right now? And I'll bet it's still not for court reasons.
Okay, probably the most well-known one right now would be Clarence Thomas.
Thank you. Yeah, pubic hairs on a Coke can.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I'm sorry, that's the first one that comes to my mind.
Probably him and O'Connor for me.
Oh, Sandra Day?
Yeah.
Oh,
and, of course, Chief Justice Roberts.
Yeah.
Because you got to know who the Chief Justice is. And there haven't been that many of them.
Yeah. He doesn't make a lot of really bold messages out there.
Mm-mm, no.
He, Yeah, I kind of like to see somebody like just fucking grab the bull by the balls and see what happens.
Well, and you know, here's what's
write some papers on this.
What's interesting with Roberts is he's actually turned out to be pretty moderate for being
Christian.
A Bush appointee and a very conservative Catholic.
Yeah.
Of course, when you look at the Supreme Court right now, they're all either Catholics or Jews.
Wait, what is Clarence?
Catholic.
Is he really?
Yeah.
How odd.
Every member of the Supreme Court right now is either Catholic or Jewish.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Probably the only place in the world you'll find where everybody working there is either a Catholic or a Jew.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
All
right.
So hooray, Thurgood. Yay.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. This day in history, August 30th, 1980. Christopher Cross has his first two number one hits with the song Sailing. So you might remember this guy. He pretty much had three songs that anybody might know. His self-titled album, Christopher Cross, in 1979, actually got him 5 Grammy Awards. I think he's the only one to have ever done it at once. First solo artist to win all 4 General Field Grammy Awards, Record of the Year, Album of the Year, Song of the Year, and New Best Artist in the same year. Pretty crazy. So, good on you, fat boy. Keep on singing.
I'm sure you've all seen videos or pictures of chimpanzees and bonobos trying to get ants with sticks or something like that, using very, very rudimentary tools where you just grab something and use it. Well, Kanzi, a 30-year-old male bonobo, has actually managed to make stone tools, and he can use these tools to dig or break into logs, and uses it to get better access to food, such as ants and the like.
Yeah,
this is incredible.
it's fucking awesome. This is over in Israel right now. There was a couple of bonobos that they had basically in captivity over there, and they taught them how to flint knap, and you know, which is pretty cool by itself. But Kanzi was able to take that a giant step further by using that knowledge of flint knapping and rudimentary tool making to basically solve puzzles, food puzzles. The researchers were putting food inside of logs that the bonobos could smell and detect, but couldn't get into them pretty much by any other means except for, well, using tools or something. Kanzi was able to get into 24 different types of food puzzles, whereas the other chimp whereas the other bonobo was only able to get into 2 of them, but only by, well, whacking the log and breaking it.
Which still works.
It worked 2 times.
Yeah, but, oh man, this is crazy. And it really just goes to show that they aren't that different. You know, genetically, we're very similar, but they're able to do things that early hominids did.
You know,
basically Neolithic tasks. You know, they've managed to teach bonobos how to light fires and cook food.
Wow.
And they've taught them how to flint knap, and now they're getting them to where they can do rudimentary stone tools to break into food or gain access to food. And this is really cool.
Yeah, we're talking about like flints, drills, scrapers. I mean, this is just amazing. There's a little video that we've seen, and I'm just thoroughly impressed. I'm actually kind of speechless. I mean, this is so cool to see problem solving on a scale like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And of course, the related videos that come up to that, a sharing bonobo, an octopus using tools, and a crow using 3 tools. Tool use has always been kind of the hallmark of intelligence. What separates man from beast, and we're finding more and more of the beasts that can use tools.
Yeah, I think most of that that is just us not paying attention to the animals and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we'd see a lot more of this in nature. It's just a feeling.
Oh, yeah. Now, I wonder how much of it is stuff you'd actually find in nature, or is it stuff that they're able to take those steps because they don't have to constantly fight to survive when they're in captivity? And yeah, okay, some very, very basic tool usage. But to the level that this that Kanzi is doing, I wonder if that would actually be happening in the wild.
I would say it's possible. You know, they're calling Kanzi a genius, but man, I'm sure there must be another one out there somewhere that can, you know, figure this stuff out and maybe teach it to others, or at least have others emulate him. But, you know, the animals out there do really cool stuff all the time. I mean, rhinoceroses will stamp out a fire in the wild, much like a much like a Bigfoot will in the Northwest.
Really? Bigfoot does that?
Yeah, yeah. That's why you can never find like good prints of a Bigfoot. Their prints on their toes and digits are burned off from the fires.
Oh, I got it. Huh. Too bad Bigfoot's not in Idaho.
Yeah, it's all that part.
We've had way too many fires here this year.
Oh, yeah. That would be a hope.
So some new research is showing that, and this is actually looking at the origin of virus outbreaks. They've been trying to trace back the origination of the Indo-European language group. And according to this new research, they are finding that it probably arose in Anatolia, modern-day Europe, or excuse me, probably arose in Anatolia in modern-day Turkey around 8,000 years ago. And
8,000 years ago? I have to interrupt. How can that be possible if the world's only 6,000 years old? Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, amazing.
Sorry.
Amazing. And that it spread from there with the expansion of agriculture. Yeah, around that time frame. The conventional theory has among linguists has always been the steppe hypothesis, that it arose in the steppes of Central Asia. And that happened about 6,000 years ago, and then it spread out from there. And they based that off of how there's very common words for wheel and chariot, or excuse me, wheel and wagon in all the different languages, and that this is where chariots first started to have widespread use, and that it would have spread with the technology.
Well, makes sense. We didn't have a word for Twitter until it was invented. That spread like wildfire.
Now, what's interesting here is you have the linguists trying to use what technology or what words fit with the technology in certain areas at certain times, where you have the archaeologists actually trying to trace it back using other methods, like viral data and the like.
I've never heard of them using viral data like that before. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I haven't either. Now, the Indo-European language family is it actually includes such languages as English, Persian, and Hindi, and it's spoken on every continent by 3 billion people.
Hot damn.
Yeah, almost half the world's population speaks an Indo-European language.
I would have never tied Hindi to that. That is amazing.
Yeah.
400 tongues.
Yeah.
That's a lot of licking.
Of course you'd go there.
Did you expect any less? Come on now. You shouldn't expect. No. All right. Yeah.
Now, the latest outbreak of West Nile virus, and this is one of the largest that's ever been seen in the U.S., is happening right now in Texas. And last year, there were fewer than 700 cases total that they'd found. And this year, 400 cases reported in the last week alone.
Holy shit.
Yeah, this is huge. As of the date of this article, August 23, there was already 1,118 West Nile infections reported. And about half of them are in Texas, mostly centralized around Dallas.
Man.
Yeah. Compare this with the 2002-2003 West Nile outbreak, where it reached nearly 3,000 people and more than 260 people died. I actually have a colleague that got West Nile in, I think it was 03 or 04, and his description of what it was like having that disease, it was absolutely horrible.
I found it kind of interesting that they're saying only about 20% of people actually get sick. Symptoms can include fever, headache, body aches. A lot of those get better in a matter of days, but about 1 in 150 people that are infected develop severe symptoms, including neck stiffness, disorientation, coma, and paralysis. That's nothing to joke about.
No, Now, actually, that kind of infection versus illness ratio isn't all that uncommon. There's lots of different diseases that have that type of breakdown. You know, like even hepatitis B, for example, if you don't have the immunizations for it, something like 25% of people that are infected with it, their body fight it off without any symptoms ever. Another 25% fight it off with minimal symptoms, and the remaining 50% have it a little bit rougher.
West Nile virus wasn't even diagnosed until 1937 in Uganda. Didn't even hit the U.S. until 1999 in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Man, but shit. And Dallas is quite the hub of travel, as I recall.
Yeah, DFW is a very major, I think, United hub.
Yeah, so that's a great springboard for viruses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anybody that's from Al-Qaeda, don't listen to that part.
No, this is a mosquito spread virus. And the typical transmission path is the mosquitoes get it from birds that have it, and then they pass it on to people that they bite.
What about pigs?
I haven't heard anything about pigs.
We get organ transplants from pigs, don't we?
On occasion, yeah.
Yeah. Must be fairly close.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah. The heart valve would be compatible with people, then the diseases would probably be pretty compatible.
Yeah. So everybody, don't eat your bacon. Send it to me.
Hmm.
Especially the deli thick slice stuff. Oh.
Hmm. All right. Time for politics. All right. So since we're into election season, of course, there's political talk is all over the news everywhere. And we don't want to get too terribly bogged down in it, but there are some really good gems that we just can't pass. Really can't pass.
Yeah. Oh, you must be talking about Aiken, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I wrote about this guy a little bit. He's a winner. And it's not just this political season. He's been doing this for a while.
So what did Aiken have to say?
Well, if you're on Facebook, I'm sure you might have heard people mentioning the phrase legitimate rape in quotes. That's one little gem that came from Aiken, basically saying, it seems to me, first of all, from what I understand from doctors, that's really rare. If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to shut down the whole thing. So basically, if you're female and you get raped, your body knows the difference and can get rid of the pregnancy or just not get pregnant or
has juices. Close off. It's yeah. Juices that it can secrete to flush out the zygote.
Yeah.
Whatever. Zygote.
Yeah. The little swimmers never get their something. It's awesome. The biology lessons that this man have given me a whole new appreciation for the female body. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and he's currently a candidate for Senate.
Well, it is Missouri after all. Come on.
Yeah. And he's on the science committee in the House.
Yeah. Yeah. I dug up found a little nugget about this guy. Claire McCaskill is actually the sitting Democrat for this Senate position. And she actually contributed to Aiken's campaign, or at least her campaign team did, to the tune of about $1.5 million, as I recall, mostly because she wanted to face off against a crazy white right-wing wingbat versus, well, one of the more saner, middle-of-the-road Republicans. I just thought that was amazing.
Yeah, that really is.
But anyways, back on track.
Yes.
Romney and Ryan wanted to make sure that they distance themselves away from this whole fervor. They put out a little statement, or at least their spokesman did. Governor Romney and Congressman Ryan disagree with Aiken's statement, and a Romney-Ryan administration would not oppose abortion in instances of rape, said their spokesman, Amanda Hennenberg.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting here with the rape exception, and I'm actually working on a blog post on this as well, it's very telling. If you compare a pregnancy caused by rape to a pregnancy caused by, you know, consensual sex, the only thing that's really different is whether or not she consented to it. So really the only difference is, was she forced into it, or is she a slut that needs to be shamed?
In their terms.
Yeah, because obviously there's no concern for the rights of the fetus in this case. They're making it very clear they don't care about that. They really just care about making sure that they slut shame women that, well, have sex.
Yeah, so if they really cared about the fetus, there would be 0%, just no abortion.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
So they're showing, they're telling that, you know, it's a matter of degree, and they don't really care about the babies.
Yeah, it's all about slut shaming, which definitely makes sense why you have all these different, you know, like in the last year, you've had all these Republican proposals for the transvaginal ultrasounds and mandatory counseling prior to an abortion and all kinds of other stuff designed for slut shaming.
Yeah, that I was actually really pissed when I heard about the transvaginal exams that they were doing. How dare they?
Mm-hmm.
That, wow. I don't even have a VJ, and that pissed me off.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So, yeah, Aiken, so far off course that he's laughably insane. Romney and Ryan, though, sound just reasonable enough, but they're not.
Yeah, within 24 hours of Aiken making these statements, the GOP basically told Aiken that they were going to stop all the funding that they were giving him. There's another group out of California, as I recall, I think it was Crossroads or Crossroads America. They pulled his ad funding that they were giving him. And this guy is still running. If he would have pulled out by Tuesday, the 21st of August, the GOP could have put in another person right in his place. But basically now he's kind of screwed the Republicans. And they'll actually have to go to court if they want to try and put somebody else in there.
Yeah.
To face off against McCaskill.
Yep. He's guaranteed that seat won't change hands.
Yeah. Which he honestly has really screwed the Republicans because he could have given them control of the Senate.
Oh, potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Oh, boy. Yeah. All right. Aiken, you might be a douche, but damn it, good on you for being what you are.
Yeah. And now to something where Romney and Obama look equally douchey. This is actually coming from the Friendly Atheist blog, and it's being taken from Cathedral Age, the magazine of the Washington National Cathedral. It's a Episcopalian church, in case you weren't aware, that sees itself as being the country's church. Well, it's not. But, you know, it's there. And it's actually a pretty cool building. I've been in it before. So they did a Q&A with Obama and Romney on issues of faith and had them both talk about their religious beliefs. And it's really pretty nauseating. Yeah.
Obama's constitutional lawyer background, he could sure do a lot better in his answers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do understand kind of where Obama is coming from. He is facing off against two very religious people. Biden is pretty damn dishwater Catholic if there ever was one. So, you know, I think he does have to pump up the church bit a little bit more this time.
Mm-hmm. You know, okay, for example, you have the question, how does faith play a role in your life? And Obama starts off with, first and foremost, my Christian faith gives me a perspective and security I don't think I would have otherwise, that I am loved. He's the fucking president of the United States, and he's concerned about whether or not he's loved? Wow.
No.
Romney, on the other hand, faith is integral to my life. I have served as a lay pastor in my church. I faithfully follow its precepts. I was taught in my home to honor God and love my neighbor. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You get to favorite passages that they have. They have, how do you view the role of faith in public life? And I think this is the one that we should really all be paying the most attention to. Obama, There are many ways to approach this question, but two clear aspects of the role of faith in public life come to mind immediately. First, faith has always provided a moral framework and vocabulary for this country to come to terms with its most pressing challenges. One of the great things about this nation is it is a place where people from all walks of life can advocate on belief of their faith and beliefs and be open about what drives and motivates them. And he rambles on for a while about slavery and suffrage movement and civil rights and all this being driven from faith, which is all complete and utter bullshit. And then Romney pipes in with, "We should acknowledge the creator as did the founders in ceremony and word. He should remain in our currency and our pledge in the teaching of our history. And during the holiday season, nativity scenes and menorahs should be welcome in our public places. Our greatness would not long endure without judges who respect the foundation of faith upon which our Constitution rests." What the fuck is he talking about?
I got a couple things I want to say real quick.
First, money.
God and everything has not been in our money since our country was founded. It's 1950s mostly. Talking about menorahs and nativities and stuff like that in public places. Fine, have them all you want in public places, just not on fucking government property or government sponsored.
And if you're gonna have it on public property, then you need to allow anybody else's displays as well.
Well, public property is public property.
Mm-hmm. It's all or nothing.
Yeah.
Personally, I'd rather have it be nothing. A lot neater and tidier that way.
I don't mind giving people their illusions.
I don't want to see the courthouse lawn. Granted, we don't have a courthouse lawn here, but you know what I mean. I wouldn't want to see that type of property being cluttered with a bunch of people's bullshit. Keep it nice and clean and to the point.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If it's on any sort of government property, either everything or nothing. I'd prefer nothing. Put it on private property all you want.
Yeah.
Or churches. Put it on your fucking church property.
Yeah, that's a good place for it.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to find the article or the actual Cathedral Age issue with this, I will have a link to it in the show notes. I don't know if I recommend reading it. It's painful. Absolutely frustrating. It's painful. Mm. And it makes me kind of not want to vote for either.
I really do hate that feeling of electing the lesser of the two evils.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, here's Obama. "I've also been blessed to receive a daily devotional from my faith advisor, Joshua Du Bois, who will send me scripture or thoughts from people such as C.S. Lewis or Howard Thurman every morning."
C.S. Lewis, really?
Yeah.
Come on.
He's got a faith advisor who sends him a morning briefing. I'd feel a lot safer if the president was starting off his morning with an intelligence briefing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, how's the pulse of our world doing?
Security and finance and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Ugh. God damn it. Obama, I like you, but you're pissing me off, man.
God damn.
And you're still the best choice we have right now. Fuck.
I really hate that. I really wish there was a better option.
I'll say it again. I think that little crazy bastard Perot would have been pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe. As frustrating as this is, let's go ahead and move on to our interview now.
So go ahead and unbutton that top button of your shirt, relax a little bit, grab a beer, and settle in.
Yep.
Yeah. Bob Price is definitely a hero of mine, though.
Yes, he rocks. Joining us now is Dr. Robert M. Price, Ph.D. He is professor of biblical criticism at the Center for Inquiry Institute, as well as the editor of the Journal of Higher Criticism. His books include Beyond Born Again, The Widow Traditions in Luke Acts, A Feminist Critical Scrutiny, Deconstructing Jesus, and The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man. He's also working on such titles as The Crisis of Biblical Authority, Jesus Christ Superstar, A Redactional Study of a Modern Gospel, The Da Vinci Controversy, and The Amazing Colossal Apostle. He's also host of The Human Bible and The Bible Geek. Dr. Price, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Bob, was there a Jesus?
If there was a historical Jesus, there isn't one anymore. That is, it's quite possible that there was a historical individual behind what I like to call the stained glass curtain of New Testament mythology and dogma and so forth. But if so, he has been so thoroughly obscured by it that there is just no way to know anymore. There might have been one way if there were any real anchorage of this figure in the history of his times, as there is, for instance, with Caesar Augustus, of whom many similar stories are told. Mm-hmm. Star signaling his birth, attempt of the wicked senators, though not as wicked as ours, to kill him when he was an infant, and all this stuff. He's the savior and so on. But there's just no way to disentangle the figure of Augustus from world history. But with Jesus, we just don't have that. The stories that seem to tack him into history, where he has contact with Herod the Great, Pontius Pilate, etc., all are at least very likely to be mythic and legendary, and which scholars think who don't entertain the notion of a mythic Jesus. But so it could be that there was a Jesus who really lived, but there's just no way to know unless somebody discovers some new evidence, and all it would take would be a contemporary letter or something, where somebody, like, let's say, a trader visiting Judea, writes home and says, I happened to hear the much vaunted Nazarene Jesus, and never a man spake as this man. That would be all we'd need to establish that, yeah, there was a historical Jesus, but there's nothing. Might be just an accident of history that there's nothing, but no evidence is no evidence. So I don't hold it as a dogma that there wasn't a Jesus, but it seems to me the burden of proof is on the one who would say there was, and I haven't seen anybody successfully bear that burden.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, who all is kind of promoting this mythicist hypothesis?
Well, Richard Carrier is a mythicist, and Frank Zindler, who's the pioneer in the American atheist movement and a Renaissance man, a polymath, whatever you want to call him, knows many ancient and modern languages. He's a neurophysicist. This guy knows everything, and he's done a lot of work on this. Earl Doherty up in Canada has written a couple of terrific books on this, and I've just learned a lot from both of all three of these people I mentioned. I forgot to mention one of them, and there are some others here and there, but I would say that Acharya S. D.M. Murdoch, she's done some amazing work about the possible astrological origins of this. Mm. And they're major people who, the great archaeologist and Old Testament scholar at Copenhagen, Thomas L. Thompson, is a mythicist, and the Irish monk, Thomas L. Brody, has just, he's done a lot of work showing that various parts of the Gospels seem to be rewrites of Old Testament stories, and not surprisingly, he has come out with it and said that there's no way there was a historical Jesus. So there's
he's a monk.
Yeah, he's a Roman Catholic monk, perhaps not for long. But there's an example of, not that you have to be a mythicist to be intellectually honest, that would be ludicrous, but this certainly shows someone who is intellectually honest, who will say such a thing at such probable personal cost. G.A. Wells was the great champion of mythicism in this generation for a couple of decades, but he eventually dropped it and embraced the view of Burton Mack that the Q source attests a kind of cynic sage Jesus to whom many legends later attached. I think that's probably a flimsy argument. I'm surprised he accepted it, but there's another guy, amazingly honest after all of these books, mm-hmm. saying there was no Jesus. He says, well, okay, you convinced me. I mean, that to me is such an inspiring thing that these people are actually open to changing their mind.
Right.
Well, Robert, you brought up the Q source a little bit. I was hoping you could go into a little bit more depth on that.
Yeah, this is kind of a foundation stone of modern gospel criticism. It's part of source criticism, something that seems abstruse and obscure, but is not really, and is very important because of the debate about how we know anything about the historical Jesus. What are the sources? And one often hears, well, I know there are contradictions between the Gospels, let's say the resurrection narratives and so on, but that's to be expected when you have four independent witnesses of a surprising event like a sudden car accident or something. They may get some of the details wrong, but they certainly agree on the main thing, and that's the way it is with the Gospels. Wait a second. I mean, that's so wrong in so many ways, but one of them is that you do not have four independent witnesses here. You have interdependent texts that the authors used one another's work. And the predominant theory of this is called the two-document hypothesis, that says it appears that the first narrative about Jesus was Mark's gospel, maybe a slightly earlier version of it with a few extra or a few less verses here and there, but essentially our gospel of Mark. And then probably more or less contemporary source of mainly sayings with almost no stories. And the German scholars that came up with this used the word Quelle, Q-U-E-L-L-E, which is just German for source. And so they spoke of the Q source, or just of Q, and then English writers started saying the Q source, the Q document, whatever. And they defined this as all of the material that you find in Matthew and Luke that you don't also find in Mark, because there's huge overlaps between these three Gospels, very often word for word. And it does seem like these are just independent compilings of oral tradition. It's just too close for that, though you can see editing and such. But you see, Matthew and Luke both overlap with Mark to such a great degree that it appears Matthew incorporated something like 95% of the text of Mark, Luke about 65 or so, and both added other material. But among that material, there's this large bunch of sayings, the Q source, that Mark doesn't have. There's two or three, well, actually, there may be about five to seven places where there are similar items between Mark and Q. That is, they're not quite the same, but they look kind of like different versions of it. Somebody heard it and repeated it as best they could, and it wound up in different forms in both sources. And sure enough, Matthew and Luke have both of them, which kind of drives home the theory that, yeah, it looks like you had Mark and Q, and then a subsequent generation, Matthew and Luke independently decided to improve them, to combine these two sources and add yet more material, which they, I think, generally made up. And then the Gospel of John seems to have known two or three of the other Gospels, but he didn't stick that close to them. He freely rewrites things and sometimes criticizes what the earlier Gospels had in there. But Q is very important. But, well, this whole thing shows that you don't have independent witnesses. There's no reason to think any of these documents came from eyewitnesses. And you get the impression that there was one narrative, the Gospel of Mark. Why weren't there a bunch of them? That automatically makes the red light go off. There was one account that other people decided to revise and add to. Isn't that a little odd if these were, like Paul says in Acts, this was not done in a corner? One other thing about Q, you seem to be able to divide it up into strata, like that it kept getting added to, very much like the book of Isaiah, which scholars divided to Isaiah, 2nd and 3rd Isaiah. that you can tell from linguistic factors, certain themes and the editing and all that. And so many scholars think there are these three levels of Q. And in the earliest one, Jesus appears to be kind of a cynic sage like Diogenes, very similar philosophy and ethics and all of that. And in no stratum of Q is there anything clearly about the death or resurrection of Jesus. And so Burton Mack, who wrote a good book on this, and others say, it looks like this comes from some kind of Christian community that didn't yet understand Jesus to be some kind of crucified savior. I mean, if they thought that was important, it's a little odd they didn't include it. Who knows? But there's certainly no evidence in this apparently very early source that would indicate they believed in the dying and rising Savior. So some people have made a huge deal out of that and said, well, this, they can't very well have believed in it and omitted it. And the huge debate, and there's room for a lot of debate, but the implications of this Q source are vast indeed. And one last thing about it. It seems to me and to Earl Doherty that it's really arbitrary to so quickly accept that these are originally sayings of Jesus. Like, no scholar really thinks the Book of Proverbs is all by King Solomon. In fact, it does give other authors for chapters of it. It surely seems like that was just a name to use for wisdom, and that people said, sounds good, Solomon must said it. Well, how do we know this Q source of sayings was even originally Christian? I mean, you just have to add, Jesus said, Jesus said, Jesus said. I doubt that it was. I think it probably was a collection of cynic maxims and aphorisms. And we know there were cynics who became Christians, and one of them probably brought this with him. So is this the closest to an authentic report of the historical Jesus we have, or does it tell us nothing about a historical Jesus? It's a big chaos. I don't know how anybody can ever decide it, but it certainly is not so cut and dried as the defenders of the faith would make it sound.
Yeah, so you take a story and then you just add a bunch of sayings to it.
Or
random.
Vice versa. Either one, yeah.
Yeah.
An entire name to it.
And even the thing I mentioned with Brody, he was one of the big inspirations for me, though there's several others, who point out in all sorts of different books how this and that story in the Gospels and Acts look remarkably like they've been rewritten from Old Testament stories, mainly of Elijah and Elisha working miracles, like multiplying the food miraculously and such. And you got to ask yourself as a historian, what's the more probable hypothesis, that a guy actually created food from nothing, or that somebody rewrote a familiar story and changed the name? The whole thing may be really pre-Christian material, Christianized to provide a biography and a bunch of teachings for Jesus. I mean, very likely. Otherwise,
yeah,
you got a heck of a coincidence.
Somebody was just applying a little homiletical license and put it down on paper, and there you have it.
So it seems that way to me. I mean, it might not be, but you're not reading the kind of thing you would expect from an eyewitness. We know what that would sound like. You'd have something like the table talk of Martin Luther. There's volumes of that where friends of his wrote down stuff he said. I've got a book called Dialogues of Alfred North Whitehead, where this guy that used to know him when he and his wife lived up at Harvard and he taught there, he was a frequent dinner guest, and when he got home he would write down this. You know, I asked Whitehead what he thought about this, and here's what he said. And Hitler, I think Albert Speer wrote a Hitler's Table Talk. Once I was asking the Führer about so-and-so, and he said, that's what you would have. And at least one early Christian understood that, because in a book called The Acts of John, which is, everybody admits, is fictional and way too late, but it poses as the adventures of John, the disciple, John, son of Zebedee, when after Jesus leaves the scene and he's preaching the gospel in Ephesus and so on, working miracles, causing pagan temples to collapse and so on. At one point, he says, "Brethren, let me tell you what it was like to go around with Jesus." And he has all these wild tales that are really fascinating. How, like, he noticed Jesus never left footprints in the sand. He never ate. He never blinked because he was like one of the Olympian gods. And so, well, this isn't history. But the thing is, this writer understood what an eyewitness account would sound like. Mm-hmm. And, let me tell you what I remember. If the Gospels are based on eyewitness testimony, there's no way to know it because that's not what it sounds like. It's just these little nuggets of stories with a punchline and what led Jesus to say this. It sounds just like all kinds of other stuff about rabbis and philosophers that nobody thinks really are eyewitness stuff.
Well, and I've looked at a fair amount of the Gnostic Gospels, much like the one you just talked about, where the only thing that really separates a lot of them from the canonical Gospels is whether or not Jesus had a physical body.
Hmm.
That's really the only difference. The Gnostics, you know, like not leaving footprints in the one you were just talking about, that's something you wouldn't have without a physical body. And the Gnostics were very much anti-matter, any kind of mm-hmm. physical matter. And so the seminar on Gnosticism I took when I was in the seminary, the professor presented the view on the book of John, the canonical gospel of John, that it was written as a response to Gnosticism, emphasizing the physical.
That is a popular view, but I'm trying to think of the name of a German scholar that wrote a systematic presentation of that. I can't quite think of it, but I didn't like it much anyway. He says, well, look at this. It says the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That's got to be anti-docetic, right? Docetism, apparent incarnationism from the word dokeo, to seem. Well, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Well, take a look at the word dwelt among us, literally tabernacled or pitched his tent among us. This sounds like it was a transitory moment that's now over. How serious an incarnation is this? Like the Christmas hymn, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. I think it's Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Veiled in flesh? I mean, that doesn't quite sound like it's an incarnation. Or in chapter 4, Jesus is talking with a Samaritan woman. The disciples have gone into the local supermarket, probably not a Piggly Wiggly, I'm guessing, and they want to get food for him, and he's waiting there and asks this woman to draw water if he can have a drink. And they get into this theological discussion. They come back with the bags of groceries, and he says his piece, and they say, "Master, eat." And he says, "No thanks. I have food to eat that ye know not of. As my food is to do the will of my heavenly Father." And so apologists say, we see there he's hungry. Don't you read to the end of the story where he doesn't need food? it's as if to say, man need not live on bread at all if he lives on every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Or the Thomas thing. Surely Jesus is raised in a physical body, right? Thomas says, unless I touch the wounds and all that, I'm not going to believe this is Jesus risen. So Jesus appears to him and he falls to his knees flabbergasted. And Jesus says, go ahead, touch the wounds. And it doesn't say that he does. And he just says, my Lord and my God. Is this, or how about when he dies? Look at this. He said, I thirst. Now that's got to be a physical man. But what does John say? He only said this because he had to fulfill a prophecy. Mm-hmm. I'm not that sure that the Gospel of John is anti-docetic. How about where they're about to stone Jesus to death? But he somehow eludes them. Also in Luke, they're about to throw him off the brow of the hill to kill him, but he passes right through him. Now, how does that happen?
Yeah,
it sounds like there are docetic traces even there.
All right, so maybe a better way of looking at it is you have this broad spectrum from physical to completely immaterial, and just a certain number of them that seemed a little less insane ended up making it into the canonical text, while the rest were discarded and often burned, literally burned up.
Yeah, this would be the ones that got in. That'd be a good example of what Mark Goodacre calls editorial fatigue, where you try to systematically change everything, but you miss something here and there. That often is you can see that in the Bible, where you do have a pattern of altering the source, but something gets through, and you have to assume that's what's happened. And my view is that in the Gospel of John, what we have is a kind of variorum addition. In the epistles of John, it's very clear there's been a schism in what we call the Johannine community, whatever it was. John's name is never actually used in any of these texts, but you can see you've got some sort of movement that has split along docetic versus incarnational lines. All the stuff, they went out from us, but that just goes to show they never really belonged with us, et cetera, et cetera. And the writer warns, if some prophet comes to you and says that Jesus Christ didn't come in the flesh, kick him out. Well, that's the issue. Well, it seems to me that if both of these groups were from the Johannine church or whatever, they both would have had copies of the Gospel of John, but would have re-edited them to support their views. I mean, we know scribes did that. And finally, a good bit after this whole thing was moot, it was long in the past, somebody was copying John and found himself comparing a manuscript, one from each side of this thing, and just put it all in. So we have constant contradictions in John. Like, for instance, Jesus says, John 14, I think, Philip says, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be sufficient. And he says, Philip, have I been with you this long, and you still don't recognize me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. Well, wow. I mean, that's what's called patripassianism, that Jesus is the Father. Well, some people didn't like that, so immediately we have this correction where Jesus backpedals and says, or don't you believe that the Father is in me and I am in the Father, whatever that means. It's just a way of getting some distance, backing away from the idea that Jesus is the Father. I think that and other places in the Gospel of John are corrected texts. Hmm. Or like in the first epistle of John. Ever notice how it says that if you're really born of God, you don't sin because you can't sin? And then it immediately says, cheek by jowl with that, if anybody sins, don't worry, we have an advocate with the Father. Wait a minute, which is it? I mean, unless this guy was a multiple personality writing this, we have a doctored up text with both sides of a debate on the same page.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's always that scenario where you have somebody writing just a note in the margin, and then the scribe gets a hold of it, it's making a copy, and it just gets written right into it.
Yes, yeah, it's, oh, geez, what is this? I guess the last guy who made this copy left this verse out and just put it in the margin. Well, I'll make sure I put it back where it belongs, not realizing it was just a gloss, as they say, a marginal comment. That's almost certainly how we got the angel disturbing the water in the pool in John 5. It didn't say why this guy complained about not being able to get to the pool in time. And the scribe understood the legend and figured, well, maybe not everybody does. Let me put this little explanation in. An angel comes down, et cetera. And he's probably right. That probably was the local legend of the thing. But this next scribe says, oh, well, that belongs in the text. I guess they left it out. And who knows how often that's happened, because we don't have manuscripts for about a century or so. They've all been destroyed, and you wonder why that happened. Well, maybe because they were systematically re-editing it and didn't want any of the earlier copies still around. Some people say, it's a conspiracy theory, but no, the same sort of thing has been taken for granted in Islam for hundreds of years. I mean, who knows if this is true? But they said that somebody came up to the Caliph Uthman and said, we're having debates on the basis of the Quran, but nobody can win because their copies don't agree. One says A and the other says B. And he says, well, we can't really have that. And so he commissioned a guy to gather up all the copies of the Quran he could find and make an official text. And then he burned all the ones collected and gave copies of the new standard edition to replace them. Well, that could easily have happened with the New Testament, and I suspect it did. And so it's virtually impossible to know how it originally read.
Well, and whether it was that or to go for a little less conspiratorial viewpoint on it, it could just be that the original manuscripts or the earlier manuscripts were just on too cheap of paper.
Yeah, that could be.
They just
be.
Didn't survive.
Yeah, that could well be.
They finally got enough money by 100 years later.
Mm. Yeah, there's just no way to know. No evidence is no evidence. And so when people say that, you're just speculating when you say this wasn't originally there, well, of course, nobody speculates on that, and that is inevitably what it is, speculation. But nobody does this without indications in the text that there's an interruption in the development of a topic, or there's suddenly a concentration of vocabulary that you don't find elsewhere in the same author. I mean, there's all kinds of good reasons for several different suggested interpolations, but scholars say, no, I'm afraid that's groundless. We're just going to have to ignore that suggestion. It's a place where they ought to be agnostic and say, well, we don't really have any manuscripts that could solve the problem, so who knows? It's up for grabs. But no, they transform agnosticism into fideism. Let's just assume that the original texts were like the ones we have. And why? Well, because we can't continue to use the text as if it were a straight writing of Paul or John or something. If we can't say we're sure that the same guy even wrote this stuff. And so it's like one of my favorite theologians, church lady, used to say, how convenient.
Awesome. Hmm. Yeah, you were involved with the Jesus Seminar, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, haven't been able to get out there in some years. I don't think they used to generously pay my way, because I haven't been able to get out there for a long time on my own. But I was the entertainment. I would always do a comedy monologue at the Saturday evening banquet. But the last time I did it, it was a big ecumenical meeting with Christians and Jews and stuff, and so I figured nobody would mind if I read part of my politically incorrect Bible, and I read my version, part of my version of the Book of Joshua, called the Book of Joshin. And it had various, I thought, funny things. So did some folks, but others took great offense, and that was the last time I was invited back. So. But they're certainly a great bunch of folks.
So
sure.
What was their whole objective?
Two things. They wanted, this was started by John Dominic Crossan and Robert W. Funk back in, I think, 1982. They wanted to systematically analyze the Jesus tradition, story by story, saying by saying. And this they did over a period of, 11 years with two 3-day meetings a year where we'd all get together one place or another. And so they wanted to debate it and talk it out. People would do papers on individual passages, and then you'd have this fascinating round table debate with about 30 or 40 New Testament scholars there hashing it out. And then we would vote on it, just like they do when these textual critics revise the Greek New Testament editions, where what they debate is, this passage isn't in all the manuscripts, but it's in this important one, but not that. So they would vote, how likely is it that this formed part of the original? Like, did Jesus really say in Luke, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do? It's not in all the manuscripts. So they'll debate that and then give each reading an A, B, C, or D rating. Well, Funk and Crossan decided, let's do the same thing in terms of authenticity. Let's use the famous colored beads to have anonymous votes. You vote a saying or a story red if you think, oh yeah, this is definitely the real thing. He did this, he said this, almost certainly. Pink if it looks most probable, but there's an element of doubt. Gray if it seems unlikely, but it's not out of the question, he might have said it. And black if you can just tell no way somebody attributed this to him after the fact. And when this took years, and I was only involved in the last few years of it. But the results came out to saying that only about 18% either of the stories or the sayings went back to the historical Jesus. And by this time, I thought that that was way too optimistic. I mean, it's not because I had a prior belief that there was no historical Jesus. I was still deliberating on that at the time. But it just seemed to me that by the criteria they used to eliminate most of the rest of it, most of what they left standing should have been cut down too. I have a chapter in my book, The Christ Myth Theory and Its Problems, called Dubious Database, where I examine what they left as authentic and show why this is inconsistent. They shouldn't have let this one through the net. And yet, it just highly amuses me that their results horrify conservatives to the point where they say the Jesus Seminar is just a bunch of lunatic fringe cranks. And that leads to the second major goal of the seminar that Funk and Crossan had in mind. They said critical scholars have poured the acid of scrutiny on this stuff for a couple of hundred years, and still most Bible readers have no idea what's going on. Let's go public with this so that people will not be able to avoid it, so the media will talk about it and debate it, and people will know, wow, what's that? You mean a lot of Bible scholars don't think it's historically authentic? Because otherwise it never leaves the ivory tower, and they certainly succeeded in that. People say, well, they were just publicity hounds. Well, that's just a pejorative way of putting it, but of course they were trying to get publicity for biblical criticism, and it worked pretty well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard biblical scholars called kind of like stamp collectors, that it's something that can be really fun to do, but not a lot of people do it, and just the majority of people out there just don't even bother reading the book that they love.
That's true. And the, you know, one thing I would love to see some sort of survey, maybe the Barna people, who are conservative Christians but do really, apparently very good, sometimes embarrassing religious surveys. They figure if something's wrong in our movement, we ought to know about it. I'd love to see them do a survey of just how many professed born-again Christians read the Bible very often, or if they've read the whole thing, etc., because they all will say, oh yeah, it's the inspired word of God. But it reminds me of a hilarious scene at a high school youth retreat I was on decades ago, where this is a fundamentalist Baptist church, but they brought in a speaker who was from an even more fundamentalist Baptist church in Texas. This guy, Brother Bill Dougherty, I mean, really like a crew cut Billy Sunday kind of a militant, but plain spoken, and he's sort of like a drill sergeant. He got up there the first night, said to this bunch of pious high schoolers, how many of you believe the whole Bible cover to cover? Every hand went up. And he said, how many of you have read the whole Bible cover to cover? Like, no hands went up. And he said, you dumbheads, how can you believe what you haven't even read? That's always stuck with me, and I'd love to know what the deal is. I have no idea. I kind of imagine that most of them read some part of the Bible every day. But I'm certain of one thing, that they're not interested in biblical scholarship. And in a sense, there's no reason they should be, because the Bible is given to them as a kind of devotional guide and documentation for the doctrines taught in their church. That's what they want it for. That's what they use it for. They have no, they're not even aware of the questions of, did this stuff really happen? Do the authors doctrines conflict? That's just not in their purview. They don't have that kind of curiosity any more than I have any curiosity about probability theory or quantum physics. I mean, I don't even have the brain for it. I'm glad other people are interested in it, but I'm not going to go spend any time. I can't, I don't have any business telling these common readers of the Bible, you know, you ought to get into the higher criticism. My gripe is only with people like William Lane Craig, who pretend to be Bible scholars and are just snake oil salesmen, basically. That I feel like I have to challenge. But the common, forgive me, pew potato, I think they're not interested in this. Why should they be interested in it? I'm not going to rock their boat. It's none of my business. So yeah, they don't know the amazing things. I've taught introductory Bible courses here in Eastern North Carolina, and had adult students say, "Geez, I never heard this in church," and it made sense to them. They liked it. Why didn't I ever hear this? And I would say, "Well, the pastor probably never heard of it either. And if he has, he knows if he starts talking this way, he'll be out of a job." But in a way, I don't. I'm guessing most of them never did hear about it, because it's just like if you're an auto repairman, you learn the auto repair manuals, and these people have as a job to be a certain kind of counselor, preacher, etc. They're not going for a position teaching biblical criticism, so I don't blame them. I just inhabit a different world completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely a problem you'll see in just about any denomination. That disconnect between the theologians, the pastors, and then the members.
The theologians don't really represent them. It's just like in ecumenical dialogue, which is a fascinating thing to me. But you quickly realize that let's say the Jews and Christians who are trying to redefine Christian claims about Jesus as the Messiah, so it'll get past the old deadlocks and all that. No matter what they come up with, they're not speaking for their constituencies. It's like there's a Jewish community of faith, of course, more than one, and the same with Christian community of faith. But these guys now belong to their own third one, the ecumenical dialogue community. And no matter what they come up with, it's never going to penetrate to the people in the pew. They're not interested in it. It really isn't for them. It's a kind of a parlor game, a head game that I find interesting, but I'm not kidding myself. And it's the same way here. I don't fault these people for, like the Rick Warren, who strikes me as really a travesty. I just can't stand the way he uses the Bible and what he makes of Christianity. But I don't expect them to go teaching Bultmann and Burt and Mack. What would be the point? So he might as well teach the Yi Jing or the Upanishads. You wouldn't expect him to do that either.
Yeah. Yeah, he wouldn't have a job very long if he did.
And why would he? I mean, he'd just be an idiot if he did. Once I heard the rector of the Episcopal Church I was going to, they go by a cycle of readings, and he said, "Well, I'm just going to preach on the Old Testament reading today, because the New Testament one is the resurrection of Lazarus, and commentaries tell me many scholars don't think this happened historically." And I practically slapped my fart, and it was all I could do not to heckle and say, "That doesn't make any difference." Of course, the story's not literally true. Isn't there some sort of lesson you want to get out of this? Well, yeah, even if there's something to say, that's not the place to say it about historical criticism, because that's not what they're interested in. It's like there's this hilarious to me, theological nerd that I am, a cartoon where this young, well-trained clergyman, I guess probably in Church of England congregation, he's there in his vestments and he's at the pulpit, and he's saying to the congregation with blank looks on their faces, I know what you're thinking, Apollinarianism, not likely. Like, you got to realize you're in a different world. And I say, why be in a hurry to disabuse these people? I take a kind of Gnostic stance on it, that these are the weaker brethren. These people are just not interested, and you're just going to stir up ill will for nothing by the imperialistic notion that you have to set them straight. So I don't try to.
And then, of course, there are some of them that you set them straight and the end result's going to be very bad.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
that do not have the intelligence or the ethical framework to be able to survive life without a belief in somebody that's watching and going to punish them if they make a misstep.
I had a good friend who was still a fundamentalist. We were both big fans of H.P. Lovecraft and all science fiction, all kinds of neat stuff. And I was surprised to learn that he was a very conservative fundamentalist. And we talked about that a bit, and he knew where I stood and wasn't threatened by it. He was a really interesting, balanced guy, and you didn't have to be saved for him to want to be your friend. And one day he told me, "Well, Bob, you know, I have to admit you're right. It is a lot of nonsense." And I knew this guy had had psychological problems and was sort of on eggshells. And I was afraid of what would happen if he really did renounce his faith. So I said to him, Chris, let's not be too hasty here. Let's not, because I felt like it really doesn't matter in the scheme of things. This guy accepts F.C. Bauer or Rudolf Bultmann as his personal savior. It matters that he's able to continue with a functional life. I don't think you got to agree with me.
And if you do, go see a shrink and get on some medication fast.
Yeah. Boy. I had a dream recently where I was up at my old alma mater, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, very conservative place, and there was some sort of conference going on, I guess apologists and people debating biblical criticism, and I went out of the building, fresh air or something, and I knew that inside they were explaining, historical Jesus stuff and all that. And suddenly, in the dream, I noticed people flinging themselves out the windows of a very high building, not that there is one there. And it was, I somehow knew it was because their faith had been shattered and they couldn't go on. I said, oh no, we got to go in there and try to bring them down. And I thought, geez, that's not going to work, because to even explain the problem is just going to dig them in deeper. And it was just a dream, but that kind of is the big danger with it. Some people, they'd be better off not knowing. That's kind of an unpopular view in certain evangelistic atheist circles, but I don't think winning arguments is always the most important thing.
I've always kind of taken that same thought when I'm talking with young Earth creationists. It's just too much to debate and get through.
Oh, yeah, that's another important angle. Once somebody asked me to write a book refuting James Patrick Holding, this really wild-eyed, ultra-conservative apologist. And I started reading through his books, and I thought, I can't write a refutation of this. There's no place to start. He's in a completely different universe in his understanding of the Bible. There's just no point of contact that I can grab onto and start arguing, here's the problem with this. So I decided to just forget it. It would be just it'd be like the myth of Sisyphus. You're rolling the boulder up the hill. As soon as you get it there, gangway, here the thing goes down again, and you got to go back to the bottom and push it up. I figured there's just no point to this.
Yeah. So what do you think the future holds? Do you think there's going to be more and more people that don't feel the need to rest their life on the belief in a historical Jesus? Do you think Christianity is going to fade away? Do you think things are just going to morph?
It's hard to tell, but I believe ultimately the fact of living in a pluralistic society is going to loosen the hold of traditional Christianity or anything else on Americans, as it's already proceeded in Europe, for instance, to do. And it won't necessarily be because of intellectual arguments. It will be the fact that you have office mates, colleagues, fellow students, etc., and even spouses that belong to another religion, and knowing them as well as you do, you simply cannot continue to think, Jesus, too bad they're going to hell. It's too bad their faith in whatever is a miserable, Satan-spawned counterfeit, whereas mine is genuine faith. It just doesn't work that way. The closer you get to people who realize, wait a minute, if I say their religious experience is counterfeit, is mine that different in kind? If I can pull the rug out from under theirs, mine goes next. I have to rethink this, and a lot of people are. I'm very surprised at surveys where a lot of supposed born-again Christians are saying, I'm not that sure you got to believe in Jesus to be saved. And more than that, we'll say, I'm not so sure I believe in a literal hell anymore. And I'm surprised to see that, but it has to happen more and more as society gets more pluralistic. People will retain a kind of backseat loyalty to their religious heritage as they do to their ethnic heritage in a pluralistic society. If you marry, like if two Catholics marry, one of them Irish, one of them Italian, and they're both American citizens, they're happy that they're Irish and Italian, but they really think of themselves as Americans. Well, if a Jew and a Christian marry, they're both happy. One's a Jew, one's a Christian, but they probably will start going to the Unitarian Church as a sort of a lowest common denominator or give up the whole thing. And I think this has to happen more and more. And so people won't renounce religion, but it won't have the same sort of defining ability that it has now. In terms of the intellectual part of it, I think there's going to be more and more slippage there because of the internet. Even Josh McDowell, one of the big apologists, as you know, he recently told people at some big apologetics conference that the big threat now to the faith of the next generation of the church is the internet, because there's all kinds of atheist propaganda sites, and people, the Christian youth, are reading that stuff, and there's no way to really respond to it adequately, to get to everybody and so on. He's probably right, and a lot of people hear about atheism, the Christ myth theory, and other religions that would never have heard of it before, and so I think there's a lot of erosion. One other thing, to my amazement, surveys indicate that there's no real difference in the incidence of premarital sex between born-again Christian youth and their non-religious counterparts. That's a major, major thing, because you just need a little more of that, like drug use or some recreational drug use, and it becomes impossible for born-again Christians to understand themselves as not being sinners, as having a mission to save their friends from sin, because they're too much like them now and don't see much of a difference. It seems arbitrary. And so I think these things are all combining to presage a real decline in the supposedly mighty evangelical Christian movement, and we're probably just some steps behind Europe headed toward a practical secularism.
Yeah, you can already find that in certain places in the U.S., places like Seattle and Portland, for example.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And seems to me you're going to have it more and more, and you don't have to be surrounded by the like-minded as you readily are in places like that if you're on the internet and happen to start looking at these dangerous sites. And like McDowell said, that probably makes a widespread declension a possibility in a way that it never was before.
Well, sounds like a very bright future.
Yeah, I think that would help. But of course, the real problem in the, I don't want to say short run, but what you have to get through first is the reaction that this always provokes. Like, we wouldn't have Islamo-fascist terrorism in the world if they weren't reacting to the threat caused Islam by secularism and modernism, where a lot of young people and professionals and scientists and so on are chucking Islam. And if Western entertainment weren't corrupting the faithful, that's what goaded these people into fury and made them think the West is the great Satan and so on. I really do not believe they're motivated by any concern for the Palestinians. The Arab countries have never lifted a jewel-encrusted finger to help these poor people. They don't really care about them. It isn't that. It's that they don't like Western culture, the egalitarianism with women and all kinds of things. They don't like it, so certain elements are having this, they're freaking out and trying to close the barn door after the horse has gotten out, and it involves killing a lot of people in the process. So there may be huge troubles with the, it's what's Anthony, what's his name? I'm getting senile. Anthony Wallace, the anthropologist, calls a revitalization movement, where a traditional culture is threatened, and they react in a last gasp effort. And I think that's what's happening with fundamentalism in this country and the actually dangerous Islamic fundamentalism. But if the whole thing, like if the direction of history weren't clear, leaving this behind, this period would not be happening. It's really death throes, I think.
So you still going to the Episcopal Church around you?
Not lately. I haven't been in about a year or so. It just sort of wore on me. That's happened before. I really love the poetry and the pomp of the liturgy, but after a while it kind of gets old, and I have to absent myself for a while, so it'll be new again. If I bother, I mean, I don't feel any obligation to, but I have certainly enjoyed it, and I'll probably dip into it again. I certainly salute it. It's I think it's a good thing, that kind of aesthetic approach to religion, but this is sort of a down period for me on that.
I don't know. Personally, I've always wanted to go to a Latin Mass.
Just I guess they have them again. They kind of ditched them after Vatican II, but I believe in at least some places they have them some of the time. And what a mistake that was to get rid of in terms of the sense of mystery that they were orchestrating. I mean, that's why they had the fancy church architecture and incense and so on. Nobody was kidding anybody. It was obviously an engineered attempt to create a certain mood, like special effects. It's not deceptive. It's obvious that was the goal. That's why they wear vestments instead of polyester suits and the pulpit and so on. And the Latin Mass was an important part of that, but they said, no, let's dumb it down. And not knowing that, I mean, they were less sensitive to what they were doing than the people in the pews were. And they knew what was being said. I mean, you have this missal, right? This guide to the Mass where it's got the Latin and the English. What do they think? they were illiterate? And it just, it's like having a Pentecostal church with no speaking in tongues. Why go? And so I think they're going, the pendulum's swinging back a little bit now. You hear these things on TV, these televised Catholic services, and you think, geez, I've heard more profound stuff than a Hallmark greeting card. The medium is the message, and they seem to have forgotten that.
I completely agree with you. Ever since they went to English Mass, the whole thing is just kind of biting them in the ass.
Yeah, yeah. There is this great little novella written by Brian Moore called Catholics. In 1973, I think, it was made into a CBS Playhouse 90 TV movie. One of the earliest things I ever saw Martin Sheen in, and he plays this radical liberation theology priest who is sent by the Vatican to shut down the Latin Mass, which is outlawed all over the world. But these monks in an island off the coast of Ireland have decided, well, people just aren't coming to church anymore. We're going to have the old Latin Mass. And sure enough, folks are flying in from all over the world to hear this thing. And they're about to have the Fourth Vatican Council, where they're going to invite the Buddhists into a theological dialogue, and they don't want this embarrassment, so they send Sheen, Father Kinsella, to shut it down. And it's really fascinating. It's just great stuff. But it deals with this issue: what exactly is relevant? The churches into liberation theology and politics. Well, you can see the point of that, but have they forgotten what nourishes a whole different side of people? And that's, this is such a great sort of a morality play or theology play about that. And this is something I think plagues the atheist, humanist, free thought, whatever movement, that there is this this left-brainedness about it, that all you need is getting your head on straight with philosophy. Well, you do need to do that. I'd rather believe the truth, what looks like the truth, than superstition. But there's a lot more to life. There's a whole affective, artistic side that they kind of just have a tin ear for. And I think that accounts for the boorishness they have toward religion. Just wanting to scour every trace of it from the public square. Most people believe in it. Well, to hell with them. The country ought to revolve around our particular tastes, and the church-state separation thing is an excuse for doing that. Why can't they step back and see what a bunch of obnoxious bullies they've become? Just the worst possible advertisements for their cause. Live and let live, I say.
Hmm. Definitely some food for thought.
Don't tell the American atheist I said that.
Wait, speaking of which, aren't you going to be in Austin?
Yeah, that's, I'm looking forward to that. I'm speaking, I guess, on, like I said, I was talking to Dave Silverman about that the other day. I'm going to be there. I think they're counting on Richard Carrier and Bart Ehrman to be there, and they are hoping to have a debate between either me and Ehrman or Carrier and Ehrman. And I said I would love to do it, but I think Carrier might be the better show. So I don't know what's going to happen if he's willing to debate anybody. He has, of course, plenty of times, but this has gotten kind of rancorous since the release of his book, Did Jesus Exist? I don't think there's much love lost between Carrier and Ehrman, so I don't know what's going to happen, but it's definitely going to be a fascinating event in March. And I'm just sort of getting to know the atheist crowd, and there are just numerous terrific people. I'm actually an honorary member of Minnesota Atheists. Actually, I guess that's part of the Atheist Alliance, but I love their approach to this stuff. They feel like, look, we don't want to antagonize people. We want to just show them that atheists are nothing to be afraid of. We're a positive group that isn't all about denying religion. We're into positive change and church and genuine church-state issues, and they do a great job. I think American Atheists is trying to come more and more to that position. They have this new theme of positive atheism, and I'm really glad to see that.
Cool.
Yeah, Minnesota Atheists just had their baseball game a few days ago. I don't know if you heard about the St. Paul Aints.
Yeah, I have a jersey. They gave jerseys to all the speakers at a conference that they and American Atheists got together and sponsored. I was out there speaking a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't get to see the game, but I heard about it. I heard it was covered on the news, and I wear my Aints jersey proudly around the house anyway. I don't want to get arrested by wearing it outside. Years ago, August Berkshire, the wise and winsome head of the group, he's a great friend. I just love this guy's approach. He debates and presents stuff in various Christian schools and secular high schools and stuff. They all know him and love him. I mean, he is the ideal ambassador for atheism. Well, he told me that years ago that the atheists in the area refer to St. Paul, Minnesota as Mr. Paul. And that's actually what the jerseys say. It says the Aints, and then underneath it says Mr. Paul. It's hilarious. I love these guys.
Oh, that is awesome.
Oh, boy. But sports bore me stiff, and somebody in the group who knew that sort of diverted me from the airport, and we went to Famous Dave's, and I had some of their great pork barbecue. Somehow we don't have Famous Dave's here. Got a lot of other great barbecue, but oh boy, I miss that place.
Yeah, I'm happy to have one in Boise.
Oh, lucky stiff. Yeah, man.
I ate there, last weekend? Weekend before last. It was quite tasty.
I hadn't been to one in a few years. I couldn't believe how great it was. I saw him on one of these cooking contest shows on the Food Network, and I couldn't believe he lost. I thought, this has got to be fixed some way. I mean, there's no way anybody beats Famous Dave.
Oh, when the waitress started explaining, I took my niece there, and the waitress was explaining to her all the different sauces.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I've tried all of them. So she brought out their special sauces that they don't put on the table.
What?
Yes. They've got this new pineapple one that's about as hot as devil spit, but sweet. Mm. And then they've got this absolutely insane, way too spicy sauce that it was painful. Absolutely.
Yeah, they were telling me about that. I, needless to say, was too much of a coward to try it. But yeah, we got the demonstration with all the different kinds.
Oh, damn it.
My daughter Victoria would just love that. She'd chug-a-lug the stuff. She has an iron stomach and loves just drinks hot sauce sometimes.
And you'll have to take her to one and see if she can handle their backroom sauce.
Oh, I'd love to.
Oh, man, it is so, so spicy.
Man, I know where I'm going for breakfast.
Gee, I never thought of a breakfast menu there. I wonder what they have.
Oh, no, it might be 1:20 in the afternoon, but I haven't eaten today.
Oh, boy, what a mecca. Culinary nirvana.
They're in White Castle. Oh, love it.
That I have a problem with, I have to admit. Or as I like to call it, white gristle. Even the smell of that stuff will send me to the latrine. Remember the commercial a few years back where this guy's on a plane and he's got a suitcase full of the darn burgers and the smell of it starts driving everybody on the plane crazy and he winds up having to turn over the burgers to the passengers? Well, I thought this is the perfect lead-in to the stereotype movie scenario where some food poison outbreak on the plane puts the pilots out of commission and they got to find somebody who can land the plane. I thought, well, this would just be perfect. You know, this guy shares his White Castle burgers and everybody's incapacitated. But, I have been to those. I'm kind of grateful we don't have those here in Eastern North Carolina. About different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, I've never actually even seen a White Castle.
Oh, there. You're lucky.
Almost exclusively East Coast.
Yeah.
That would explain it.
New Jersey, yeah. They also have Blue Castle and other
things. And crystals.
Who knows what on earth might be in that. I'm not going to find out anytime soon.
All right. Well, we probably shouldn't use up any more of your time, Bob.
Yeah, it's great talking with you guys.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure having you on.
Any old time.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
It'll distract me from more dubious pursuits.
All right. And where can people find out more about you and more of your material?
Oh, I got this website, robertmprice.mindvendor.com. It's vendor spelled with an O-R. robertmprice.mindvendor.com. That's got archives of my articles, my book reviews, movie reviews, sermons, lectures, fiction, everything, all kinds of stuff. And so there's all manner of things there.
All right, and I'll put a link in the show notes.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure. Hope to talk with you again sometime soon.
All righty. Well, have yourself a good one.
You do.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zune, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.